The new government in Syria is holding elections in what is seen as a critical moment for the country.
You know, Syria's transition is in an extremely dangerous and fragile spot.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also, a major bicycle race in Spain disrupted by protesters.
Es que sabéis que hoy termina la Vuelta a España.
Spain's prime minister supports the demonstrators.
Building the next generation of firefighting aircraft in Canada, and a far-right rally in London attracts big crowds.
It was about great replacement theories, so it was really racist stuff.
Plus, a global charm offensive taken by the last monarch of Hawaii.
The late 19th century was a dangerous time for small Pacific Island nations.
That's all today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us today.
We begin in London, which saw one of its biggest far-right demonstrations ever over the weekend. More than 100,000 people joined an anti-immigrant rally under the slogan, Unite the Kingdom.
Are you ready to fight for your future, Britain?
Fight for your future.
Do it. Go!
Will we be gagged any longer, Britain?
That's the rally's organizer, Tommy Robinson, speaking to the crowd. Elon Musk joined the rally by video link. During his appearance, Musk expressed pride in his own British heritage and talked about immigration as an existential threat.
To go deeper into what the anti-immigrant rally means for the United Kingdom, we reached out to Elizabeth Pearson in London. She's the author of Extreme Britain, Gender, Masculinity, and Radicalization.
It's the biggest number of supporters that Tommy Robinson has succeeded in bringing to the streets. And I think it's only been topped in terms of London protests by a pro-Palestine protest in 2023. So it does mark something of a shift in terms of the visibility of Tommy Robinson, perceptions of legitimacy of Tommy Robinson, and the willingness of a real mix, including lots of, in inverted commas, ordinary people who turned up to this protest on Saturday.
What was the build-up to this rally in terms of people's motivation for joining it?
Ostensibly, this was a free speech rally. Tommy Robinson has been quite outspoken about lack of freedom of his own speech. He's an anti-Islam activist, and so a lot of his rhetoric over the years has been very Islamophobic. But when you look at the speakers who were invited to address the crowds, one of them being Elon Musk, much of this speech was not really about free speech. It was about immigration. It was about British heritage, culture. It was about whiteness, whether explicitly mentioned or in dog whistle terms. It was about great replacement theories. So it was really racist stuff.
So clearly, Tommy Robinson is a polarizing and controversial figure in the UK. I know you were not at the rally, but there were over 100,000 people there, including children. More widely, what is his audience today?
In the past, his audience was, I would say, people who didn't mind being stigmatized with that kind of far right label. He's always sought to move into the mainstream, to normalize his views. I am not entirely sure who his audience is, because at that protest, we had white supremacist type re-migration advocates. So really hard far right neo-Nazi kind of views.
Remigration meaning essentially deport yourselves or go back to your home countries. That's what they're...
Yes. Make Britain a place that is for the British, although Britain has for many decades been a multicultural country, and being British is not about being white. But there's plenty of people who would like it to be that, some of whom will say just stop all future immigration, some of whom will say remigrate illegal immigrants, and others of whom would like to quite forcibly, violently remigrate anybody who isn't white, essentially. And I think all of these demographics will have been present on Saturday, and people for whom far-right ideology is absolutely meaningless. They just think it's a good day out, a chance to wear a Union Jack, and they're anti-immigrant and they simply don't mind or don't pay any attention to the more far-right language of the kind, actually, that Elon Musk was espousing.
Right. Well, we heard the clip of Elon Musk speaking by video link at the rally. Why is Musk weighing in, and what is his relationship with Tommy Robinson and the British far-right nationalist movement?
So Elon Musk clearly wants to impact democracy. He called for the dissolution of parliament. He's been extremely critical of our prime minister. This is quite unprecedented. So what does he want? It seems that he wants to destabilize our democracy, to institute and to support people into power who support an anti-immigration agenda. The concern is that, as the rally on Saturday showed, that there are more and more people who, even if they don't agree with or even understand what re-migration is, don't mind going along to a rally where that is supported, where there are far-right speakers. And of course, there will be many people at that rally who would absolutely support those ideas. And to me, this is an extremely troubling shift.
London obviously is a very diverse city, very multicultural. I wonder what's known about how people of color and immigrants in the UK are feeling after all of this, after this rally.
I am not a person of color, and I wouldn't want to speak on anyone's behalf. But I have read in the papers and just speaking to people that, you know, some people say to me, look, don't take any notice of this stuff. It's easy to think, because they get airtime, that this is what most people think, but most people don't think like this. Whereas others are feeling increasingly uncomfortable. Things like, we've had St. George flags, you know, the flag of England, the red cross on a white background, painted on people's houses recently, in recent weeks. And things like this, attacks on asylum hostels, Tommy Robinson's protests, all of these contribute to a culture and a feeling of insecurity for Britons who have a background of migration or who are people of colour. And for many of us, I think it makes the country feel like a different place and not a better one.
Elizabeth Pearson is the author of Extreme Britain, Gender, Masculinity and Radicalization.
The prestigious bicycle race, La Vuelta, goes back to 1935. Spain was hosting this year, and the race ended Sunday after 3 weeks riding through 21 stages. But not a single cyclist crossed the finish line. On the final stretch of the course, activists tore down barricades and blocked the route for the cyclists. The protesters were opposed to an Israeli team racing because the demonstrators say Israel is committing genocide in Gaza. Spanish citizens and their left-leaning government have become some of Europe's most outspoken critics of Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza. From Barcelona, The World's Jerry Haddon reports.
Big races like La Vuelta always come with risks for the world's top riders. Accidents at high speeds can and do happen, but this year brought new dangers. This was stage five of the race along a quiet country road in Spain's northeast. Suddenly, dozens of protesters appear carrying anti-genocide signs. The pro-Palestinian crowd blocks the road just as the Israeli team, called Israel Premier Tech, comes whizzing around a corner toward them. Motorcycle police out front try to disperse the activists to no avail. Premier Tech and its support cars come to a chaotic halt. During another stage, protesters lunge into a stream of bikes as they careen past. Orange-vested policemen chase the activists, trying not to get run over. The Israeli bikers slip past this time, but one Italian cyclist isn't so lucky. He ends up on the asphalt. In all, six of the last 10 stages of La Vuelta were cut short or canceled by pro-Palestinian protesters. These sorts of interruptions are unprecedented in the 90-year history of the race. But, say activists, so is Israel's destruction of Gaza. It's shameful that some people call us protesters terrorists, said this young woman yesterday on Spanish TV, while allowing cyclists from a genocidal state to participate in a sporting event. Genocide. That's a term many experts on conflict use to describe what Israel is doing in Gaza. They say Israel is starving Palestinians and indiscriminately bombing and shooting civilians. For their part, Israeli officials insist they are following the rules of war in their fight against Hamas. But European leaders have grown increasingly uncomfortable with what they see as Israel's brutal response to Hamas's October 7th attack, when assailants killed more than 1,200 people and took hundreds more hostage. But the EU has shied away from using the word genocide, except for one of its leaders, the guy hosting La Vuelta.
Nosotros no comerciamos con un estado genocida. No lo hacemos, señoría. Y creo que el otro día...
Our government will not do business with the genocidal state, said Spanish Socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez in May. He was speaking to Spain's Congress. Soon after, Spain recognized Palestinian statehood. This month, it halted all arms sales to Israel, barred travel to Spain for Israelis linked to atrocities in Gaza, and it also closed its airspace to flights carrying military supplies to Israel.
España, como saben, no tiene bombas nucleares, tampoco tiene portaaviones.
While announcing the measures last week, Sanchez said, "We don't have nuclear bombs or aircraft carriers, so we alone cannot stop the Israeli offensive in Gaza. But that doesn't mean we won't try." Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tossed the G word back at Sanchez, calling the Spaniards' comments a blatant genocidal threat against Israel. Spain has called on members of the European Union to enact embargoes of their own, but the EU remains divided.
What is happening in Gaza has shaken the conscience of the world. People killed while begging for food, mothers holding lifeless babies.
This was EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen speaking in Brussels a week ago. She proposed some sanctions on certain Israeli ministers and violent settlers, but admitted it would be tough to get all 27 members to sign off. Meanwhile, Spain's Pedro Sanchez isn't waiting around. Yesterday, speaking at a Socialist Party gathering, he threw his support behind protesters disrupting La Vuelta cycling race.
Es que sabéis que hoy termina la Vuelta a España. Y vaya por delante nuestro reconocimiento y respeto absoluto.
Above all else, Sanchez said, we offer our recognition and respect to the cyclists, but at the same time, we admire our own citizens for mobilizing behind just causes, such as Palestine. Soon after those comments, mobilizing citizens stormed the streets and blocked the finish line in Madrid. Race organizers scrapped the award ceremony, denying Danish winner Jonas Vingegaard not one, but two moments of glory.
Algunos lo celebrarán como un triunfo, incluyendo el presidente del gobierno, al cargo directo responsable de lo que ha pasado.
Some might claim today as a victory, lamented Madrid's mayor, conservative José Luis Martínez Almeida, including, he said, our prime minister, who I blame for all this. Violence, he said, in the aftermath of the chaos Sunday, defeated sportsmanship. Even the president of La Vuelta, Javier Guillén, said there wasn't a single positive takeaway from yesterday's disruptions. But whether it's conviction or politics, Pedro Sanchez is standing firm. He's calling on Israeli teams to be banned from all international sports events. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, Barcelona.
It's not a sporting event that anyone was asking for, but it happened.
Wow, now look at the crowds. Look at the crowd.
Over the weekend, Vienna hosted the first ever World Tram Driver Championship. That audio is from the event's official live stream on YouTube.
Teams representing 25 different countries from cities including Hong Kong, San Diego, and Rio competed in 8 challenges as they piloted streetcars. Thousands of spectators showed up lining the streets where they were driving.
Some of the challenges were straightforward, stopping, accelerating, and backing up smoothly. Others were a little more fun, like driving with a bowl of water attached to the front of a streetcar and trying not to spill anything, or something called tram curling, where drivers tried to push a smaller trolley and get it to stop in a specific spot.
Goodness, this is really, really exciting. This is such a tight race right in the moment.
In the final round, the competition was neck and neck, or whatever the tram equivalent of that is. The home team, Austria, took the lead after knocking down every pin but one in tram bowling. Then Poland, a favorite to win, had a chance to snag the title. But after coming up short in the tram curling portion, the Polish drivers failed to take the lead, and Austria was the big winner.
Austria is the champion. Austria is the first winner of the World Cup. The host of the first World Cup gets the title. They got it. Now look at that.
The head of Austria's team said he was overwhelmed and speechless after winning in his native country. And, you know, Carolyn, there was no mention of a home team advantage, which is a little weird because all the teams from all over the globe were all steering those Viennese trams.
So maybe a home tram advantage, am I right?
Yeah, I think that's the way to put it. Maybe next year will be Poland's time to shine in this event with the second ever World Tram Driver Championship scheduled to be held in Warsaw.
And coming up, more traditional athletics, stunning results from the World Marathon Championships. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Massive wildfires are prompting countries around the globe to take a look at their firefighting capabilities. One tool that's in high demand is a water bomber airplane that can scoop up water, say from a nearby lake, and drop it on wildfires. We asked Paul Peterson to explain what makes these kinds of aircraft so valuable. He's executive director of the United Aerial Firefighters Association based in Washington, D.C.
Specifically with scoopers, if there's water within 15 to 20 minutes, they'll land, scoop for about 30 seconds, and there's two scoops that are on the bottom of the aircraft that are about the size of a piece of paper. And that pressure just from the forward speed, fills those tanks in about 30 seconds.
So I understand the demand has been increasing for these planes. Is that right?
The demand for firefighting aircraft, not only in the United States and Canada, but across the world, continues to go up every single year. For example, there's single engine air tankers that are based on ag planes. 3/4 of those are going overseas right now. So they're going to Europe, they're going to Turkey, they're going to Greece, they're going to Australia.
I know there are different types of firefighting aircraft, but there is just this one company that builds this type of plane. Why is that?
Well, there's a number of companies that build firefighting aircraft. Canadair, De Havilland, currently it's the only specially built just for fighting fire. There's another company out of Bentonville, Arkansas, Game Aerospace, that is building a single engine air tanker specifically for firefighting. It is a new one, and it'll test fly probably in the 1/4 of 2026.
Oh, okay. So there's a new company entering the market for these firefighting aircraft. So that is another sign of these increasing fire seasons.
Yes. Yeah. And like I said, the demand, not only in the United States, but across the world, we could probably have double the amount of aircraft that's out there. And that gets us pretty close to what we need. But every single year when the peak of the fire season in July, August, September, there's not enough aircraft to meet that need.
Wow. And different countries do come to each other's aid, right? So these might be deployed where they are needed from different countries. And even then, there's not enough.
Yeah, and generally between the Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere, there's some sharing of aircraft. But, what we're seeing is it's becoming a more of a year-round fire season. And that split between the Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere starting to merge a lot closer. And so then when you have like worldwide competition between firefighting aircraft, you have to bring more into the mix.
So this new model of water bomber being built by De Havilland Canada, it won't actually be deployed until what I think 2028 is when the first one will be delivered. How, if there need to be double the aircraft to fight fires that exist now, right now, what do you see as the need for firefighting capacity going into a hotter and often drier world?
You have at a local, state, province, federal, international level, that demand of firefighting aircraft increasing. And the problem is you just don't go down to the air tanker store or the scooper store on the corner and pick a couple up. There has to be funding and contracts in order to support the development and the purchase of those aircraft. And that's where it comes back to at a state, a province, at a federal, local level. Those individual government agencies have to plan for that.
Paul Peterson is the executive director of the United Aerial Firefighters Association based in Washington, D.C. The world's best track and field athletes are competing at the World Athletics Championships in Tokyo right now. And in the marathon, there are some results that no one could have predicted. The world's Bianca Hillier is here to tell us about it. Hey, Bianca.
Hey, Carolyn.
So set the scene for us here. We are in Tokyo and there is a heat wave, right? I do not envy these marathoners.
No, me neither. It was really hot for both marathons. I mean, we're talking around 85 degrees with 70 to 80% humidity. So yeah, athletes were out there on the course sharing water bottles and passing around bags of ice to each other throughout the race. But of course, they're all dealing with the same conditions. So, fair playing field.
Equally punishing for everyone, at least. All right, let's start with the women's race here. How was that surprising?
Well, because of the weather conditions, the pace was never going to be world record pace, which is fine because these kinds of championships are all about a podium finish and getting a medal. So in the final couple of miles, there were two women right there next to each other, Kenya's Paris Jepchirchir and Ethiopia's Tigist Assefa. And it came down to the final 100 meters when Jepchirchir gritted her teeth, dug deep, and just went for it. She crossed the finish line first, but it's actually the third place runner who's getting more attention.
Oh, wait, tell me why.
Well, it was simply just so unexpected, and not just for the fans, but for the runner herself, Yulia Paternine.
She's counting the other finishers. She's going, where have I finished? I finished third. You're a world championship bronze medalist, Yulia, for Uruguay.
Wait, so this runner crosses the finish line and doesn't know until she counts the people who are already there with her that she got third place?
Exactly. She even held up three with her fingers, you know, asking people around her, am I really in third place?
That's crazy.
Yeah, and it is pretty typical for runners to be a bit out of it at the end of a marathon just from exhaustion, but this was a different kind of disbelief. It turned to utter elation, of course. Paternine is 25 years old. She's raised in the UK, but all of her family is from Uruguay, and it's the country's first ever medal in any event at these World Athletics Championships.
Oh, wow. So she was surprised, and she's also kind of making history here. I'm sure she's thrilled.
Absolutely. After the race, she said that, you know, the 3 million people in Uruguay have a lot of pride, and she hopes her run can inspire people.
I think it's great for younger athletes to see that they have a role model out there, that even if you are from one of these smaller countries, doesn't matter. You still got to put in the work, and anyone can do it.
All right. I don't think anyone can run a marathon or be a world-class marathoner, at least. But point taken. All right, Bianca, tell us now about the men's marathon. Also, I am assuming hot for that one.
Oh, yeah. Just as toasty for them and an even crazier finish. So you know the saying, it's a marathon, not a sprint?
Yes, of course.
Okay, well, forget about that. Elite marathons, they are now a sprint. At least this one was at the end. With 100 meters to go, Germany's Amanal Petres opened up his stride and he got a good 3 to 4 meters ahead of the guy in second, Tanzania's Alphonse Simbu. But with just a couple of steps to go, Simbu somehow found another gear and pressed on the gas.
Wow! We need a photograph after 26.2 miles to decide who gets the World Championship gold medal.
It was a photo finish with a smaller margin of victory than even the men's 100-meter dash, which is, of course, an actual sprinting event. In the end, the photo showed that Simbu crossed the line just a hair ahead, giving Tanzania their first gold medal at these championships. One of those sports moments, Carolyn, where, you know, you just sit there stunned for a good 30 seconds, like, what just happened?
Yeah, it's incredible that they're so close after 26.2 miles. The world's Bianca Hillier filling us in on some of the highlights from the track and field world championships in Tokyo. Bianca, thank you so much for this bit of light today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Carolyn.
This is The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Syria is about to take a big political step. It's holding its first parliamentary election since the fall of former dictator Bashar al-Assad in December of last year. This is not a general election, says Syrian voters are not heading to the polls. Still, it marks a significant moment in the country's transition to democracy. The election also raises a lot of questions about representation within the new government. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
Ahmad al-Shara seemed to have left a positive impression on President Trump when the two met in Saudi Arabia back in May.
Young, attractive guy, tough guy, you know, strong pass.
When he met with Trump, Shara had come a long way from his days as a rebel leader in northwestern Syria with a $10 million bounty on his head. He traded his fighting garment and rough beard for a suit and a tie. The man that fought the Syrian government and its allies for years was suddenly in charge of Syria. This week's parliamentary elections mark a key moment for the country under his leadership, says Mona Yacoubian. She heads the Middle East program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
You know, Syria's transition is in an extremely dangerous and fragile spot.
Yacoubian gives a 5 out of 10 mark for Ahmad al-Shara's performance so far.
Today's Syria is certainly a far cry from the brutality of the Assad regime, but there are very troubling developments as well.
This summer, violent clashes broke out between Bedouin clans and members of the Druze community in southern Syria. It was the latest episode of internal conflict. The Druze are a religious minority in Syria. The fighting left hundreds of people dead, thousands were displaced. The Syrian government intervened, but its forces face accusations that they robbed and killed Druze civilians.
These episodes of communal violence point to a much deeper problem, which is how Shara is managing Syria's minority communities.
Last spring, clashes broke out in the Alawite community. Rights groups reported mass killings and said over 1,000 people were displaced. The Alawites are a minority religious sect in Syria. The Assad family belongs to that group. Syria is a diverse country with many religious and ethnic groups. Mona Yacoubian points to another group, the Kurds, in the northeast. They've been running an autonomous region for about a decade.
They have an army some 100,000 strong, and they look at these episodes and they say, we're not going to integrate our forces and our governance into this current Shara government unless they start to really change their practices with respect to minorities.
The parliamentary elections are happening against this backdrop. At no point in the process have Syrians voted for this transitional government. About a third of the seats will be appointed by Shara himself. The rest will be elected through a system of appointed bodies in each province. Alaa Sheikh Hassan is a photographer in Damascus.
We have a government of the party that won the war. This is not yet a democratically elected government that actually represents Syrians.
Hassan says so far, government reconstruction efforts have focused on larger cities.
The big betrayal that I think many people would feel that is not well documented or talked about enough is the betrayal of the countryside.
The areas that bore the brunt of the destruction from the war, he says. Adam Weinstein with the Quincy Institute says when it comes to inclusivity, Shara and his circle seem to have kept the mentality of their fighting years.
The way they've survived this long has been to keep their friends very close to them and be very suspicious of outsiders. And so now that they have to rule over the entire country, being inclusive does not come naturally to them.
On the international stage, Shara has done great, he says. The U.S. lifted its sanctions on Syria, which has seriously hurt the economy.
They've said all of the right things. They've been able to present themselves well at international fora. The problem is that honeymoon phase is ending a little bit.
The world is going to expect real progress on the ground, he adds, particularly when it comes to the killings on the coast and in Sweda province. On Friday, Shara met in Damascus with the commander of the U.S. Central Command, as well as the U.S. Special Envoy for Syria. The meeting would have been impossible to imagine a few years ago. Munayagobian explains that the parliamentary elections, while symbolic, carry an important message about the future of the country. Sharawa is also heading to New York to participate in the United Nations General Assembly.
It's an historic moment to have this former al-Qaeda leader, now transitional president of Syria, coming to the United Nations, having the ability to address the General Assembly.
According to Syrian media, the results of the elections will be announced at the end of this month. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
A court in Nigeria has sentenced a top leader of a militant group with links to al-Qaeda to 15 years in prison. Mahmoud Mohamed Usman pleaded guilty to engaging in illegal mining and using the proceeds to bankroll terror attacks staged by his group Ansaru. The Nigerian government has brought more than two dozen other charges against Usman, most of which are still playing out in court.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the first delivery of the Ebola vaccine has arrived in the epicenter of the current outbreak there in the country's south. 400 doses were brought in on a United Nations peacekeeping helicopter on Friday, with a lot more expected in the coming days. Almost 70 suspected cases of Ebola have been identified since the outbreak was confirmed on September 4th.
And in South Africa, an apartheid-era law banning husbands from taking their wives' last names has been ruled unconstitutional by the country's highest court. This is after two couples brought a lawsuit against the Department of Home Affairs. One couple wanted to hyphenate their family names, and the other couple wanted to take the wife's last name.
And those are a few things you might have missed.
Reading and writing are cornerstones of primary education around the world. In English-speaking countries, that means learning the ABCs. We even have songs to drill those 26 letters into our brain. In the UK in the 1960s, some school children were actually taught that there were 45 letters. Those letters made up the initial teaching alphabet, or ITA. It was an educational experiment that was supposed to make learning to read more intuitive for kids, but it backfired, leaving some students with lifelong issues with spelling. Dominic Wise knows all about this. He's a professor of early childhood and primary education at the Institute of Education, University College London. He joins us. Professor Wise, what exactly is the initial teaching alphabet, and how did this idea in the English language curriculum end up with 45 letters?
Well, the ITA was a way to try and simplify the complexities of the English spelling system or orthography. And what it did was it created some new symbols to represent the different sounds of spoken English language, and we call those sounds phonemes. And so what you end up with is a kind of mixture of what we know as conventional letters in the alphabet, but also some quite strange-looking symbols that stand for different phonemes.
So kids who learn this alternate spelling alphabet, what do we know about how they did later on with literacy and spelling?
Not too much evidence around, but from what I've read over the years, quite a lot of people have sort of said that they put down their poor spelling to the fact that they were introduced to this ITA. Mm. Now, having said that, of course, we don't know, because they could have been poor spellers anyway, even if they'd had a more conventional primary education. But the big claim is that it didn't help people's spelling, and it made them less good at spelling in the end.
Cognitively, do we know why ITA held some kids back with spelling issues for the rest of their lives?
Well, my sort of hypothesis about this is that if you teach children one system that is not the real system, they have to unlearn the first system and then start working out the real system. And so that must lead to confusion, I think. It's also time when they are not learning, you know, how to spell. Now, we do know, we do have research evidence on how to help children learn to spell. And one part of that is they need to learn that they learn to crack the code. So they learn that the letters of the alphabet have different ways to represent speech sounds. But they also crucially need to learn about the irregularities of English. So they learn to look visually at words. And a classic example might be the pattern of letters O-U-G-H, you know, where you get the word rough, as in a rough surface. and then through is completely different. In fact, there's some lovely, very funny examples on the internet of people making fun of this kind of English spelling nightmare.
I've seen those. Yeah, they're pretty funny. You said a moment ago, Dominic, that ITA was a failure. Are you of the school the alphabet with 26 letters had worked for many centuries? Why change it?
I suppose I am, really. I mean, whether we like it or not, the English language has this complex history that means there isn't, you know, in other languages such as Spanish or Italian, you have a more regular pattern of letters representing sounds. We don't have that in English, but most children do learn to read and write successfully. Of course, there are those who struggle, who need more help. But I think the rich history of the English language is living in its spelling system. And I would feel sorry if we lost that.
Yeah, and different pronunciation, which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, agreed.
Do you know of ITA success stories?
I don't really. Sorry. no, I'm afraid I can't think of a single one. I mean, I know in that there were just a couple of people who said that they thought it was helpful. But it seems to me on balance, the negatives are outweighing the positives.
I don't know if you underwent any ITA education, Dominic, but are you good at spelling today?
I would say I'm pretty good at spelling. I've lost count of the amount of books I've written, some of which have been directly about the English language and its history. But I know other people who I would say are, for example, better proofreaders than I am and so on. And like most people, there are some spellings I just sort of scratch my head and think, now, which way is it?
That's Dominic Wise, a professor of early childhood and primary education at University College London, UCL. He was explaining the long tail of questions from a spelling experiment in the 1960s.
Overfishing is a big problem. In many areas, fishing fleets are hauling in catches faster than the fish can naturally recover. Many governments around the world are actually encouraging overfishing by subsidizing the ships responsible for it. A new global effort to address this problem went into effect today. It's the World Trade Organization's first binding multilateral environmental deal. Callum Roberts is a professor of marine conservation at the University of Exeter's Cornwall campus in the UK. We spoke earlier today, and I started by asking him why the treaty bans certain types of subsidies for the fishing industry.
When fishing gets harder because stocks are falling, and instead of reining in that fishing capacity and reducing the amount of fish being caught, government's first reaction is to support the fishing by offering breaks on taxes or on fuel, for example, or permitting people to buy fishing vessels more cheaply. And by reducing the costs of fishing, they keep people fishing even on overfished stocks.
This also ends subsidies for vessels and operators engaging in illegal fishing and also fishing in international waters beyond national jurisdiction. Why are governments subsidizing illegal fishing in the first place?
That's a really excellent question. And often it's because the database where a prosecution of a vessel is recorded is not the same one as the database that's offering subsidies for the fisheries. Governments are not keeping joined up records, and so they are incentivizing and giving taxpayers money to vessels that are acting illegally in many cases. So that was an easy win for the World Trade Organization. You know, most people think that that's a bad idea. The more significant subsidies are still the subject of negotiation. So
right.
We haven't reached a formal agreement yet on, for example, fuel subsidies, which is the biggest overall kind of subsidy, which is driving overfishing of the world's fish stocks.
Right. So tell me more about that second phase of this agreement that has not been finalized yet, that is more controversial. I understand that India and Indonesia are two countries that have not signed on to it. You mentioned the fuel subsidies. What else are they still negotiating over, and why would that have a bigger impact, as you say?
Obviously, in the world's poorer nations, provision of fish is an important social good. You know, we do it because we need food, good access to nutrition for the people of these countries. And one way that governments seek to achieve that is by offering subsidies of one form or another to encourage people to get into fishing. Of course, those fisheries can end up eating the resources that they depend on. I think many countries are walking a very fine line here, using subsidies to encourage people into fisheries whose capacity hasn't really been assessed properly as to how much fishing they can support.
As we mentioned, there's a first part of this agreement that's been agreed to. There's more that hasn't, and that would ban fuel subsidies and subsidies for example, building fishing boats that would then put more fishing boats out in the sea.
Exactly, yes. The subsidies that drive overcapacity in the first place are remaining controversial and have still to be tapped. But at least this agreement takes us in the right direction. It encourages and requires transparency and reporting of all the subsidies that governments do offer to their fishing fleets. So once in the sunshine of daylight, then I think we will see much of scrutiny.
Right. Does it have teeth to enforce these new provisions? There are a lot of international environmental agreements that have done little to actually move the needle. Would this be any different?
The teeth that an agreement like this has is market access. So if a country is seen to be subsidizing its fisheries and promoting unsustainability in those fisheries, then it becomes very difficult for retailers who want to show off their environmental credentials to buy fish from those countries.
Can I just step back and have you explain the scale of the problem here and why it is such a problem for people all over the world, overfishing? Why does it matter?
Well, overfishing is destroying what's supposed to be a sustainable resource for the long term. We could fish the seas productively indefinitely if we were to take only as many fish the population is producing in a year. And so it is in everybody's interest to avoid overfishing, because then we will be able to exploit the ocean for seafood in perpetuity. Sustainable use would be very simple if everyone could agree to take a little bit less.
Callum Roberts is a professor of marine conservation at the University of Exeter. He's been speaking with us about a new global treaty aimed at stopping overfishing.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. There will be a lot of focus this week on the so-called special relationship between the United States and Britain. President Trump is heading to the UK tomorrow for another state visit. The next couple of days will be full of formal receptions, face-to-face meetings and photo ops, ceremonial dinners, all meant to solidify the ties between the US and the UK.
These sorts of diplomatic trips are nothing new, but one particular example from history caught our attention. In 1881, the last king of Hawaii became the first head of state to circumnavigate the globe. King David Kalakaua's diplomatic tour was 9 months long.
He had tea with a fellow monarch, Queen Victoria, in England, got a blessing from Pope Leo XIII, opened dialogue with China, Japan, and Portugal, and he met American President Chester A. Arthur. The U.S. would overthrow Hawaii's monarch and annex the islands before the century was over.
I recently spoke with Douglas Askman, a history professor at Hawaii Pacific University in Honolulu, about King Kalakaua's global diplomacy tour of 1881.
Well, King Kalakaua was the last king of the Hawaiian Islands, although not the last monarch. And his project to go on this world tour in 1881 was part of the bigger concept that he and other Hawaiian royals had, which was to establish diplomatic relations and contact and friendly diplomatic relations with other countries around the world. So this trip was a world trip in 1881, but he'd already taken early in his reign a state visit to the United States. So it was part of a bigger project that the king conceived of.
How did he actually travel? I'm assuming by boat for the most part. What else?
Yes, he traveled by boat. And so this was a world tour, so it involved more than just Europe. But he traveled primarily by ship. And then when he got to Europe, he traveled by train quite a bit as well.
I'm also curious about, like, the official dress on this tour. When I think of this time, my mind goes to sepia photographs, officials in their local finery. How did the king present himself? In traditional Hawaiian garb or in the latest Western styles?
No, he would have worn Western clothes. By this time, Hawaiian royals primarily dressed in Western attire. He wore sort of civilian clothes, but he also had uniforms as well. He was very fond of military uniforms, and he sometimes wore his decorations that he received from other countries and also those that he got from Hawaii as well. So he would have presented himself in a way that Western monarchs would have done.
So this 9-month trip that the king took around the globe, what was Hawaii's standing internationally at that time?
It was a diplomatically recognized country, so it was very small, but Hawaii had contact with many countries, the United States, European countries, countries in Asia as well. And in the 19th century, toward the end of the 19th century, Hawaii had about 100 diplomatic posts all around the world.
So I gather the king did some pre-trip publicity in the Hawaiian Islands. Like even before going, he was meeting his subjects, explaining what he was setting out to do and where he was going. What were Hawaiians expecting from his diplomacy? Like, what was riding on it for them?
I think there were a couple of issues that the kingdom was facing. One was an issue about immigration. So the kingdom was big into the sugar industry in the late 19th century, and there was a need for immigrants to work in the sugar industry. And immigration had already been going on, but there was always a demand for more immigrants. So part of the king's project was to seek out different places that immigrants might come from to Hawaii, and also to build diplomatic relations. I think this was a very important part of the trip, to cement relations with other countries, to publicize the kingdom. So in a lot of ways, it was a PR tour. It was a way to make Hawaii known all around the world.
Were there critics? Like, I can imagine locals raising an eyebrow for their king going on a 9-month world tour.
So for the most part, Hawaiians were very positive about the king's trip. But there was a small group of Western businessmen who were in the kingdom who used this as a way to attack the king, especially the spending. So the trip was expensive, although the exact amount of the trip is not known. So there was a small group of critics, but they were quite vocal about the king's trip and about some of his other projects as well.
I'm speaking with Douglas Askman, professor of history at Hawaii Pacific University, about Hawaii's last king, King David Kalakaua, the first head of state to travel around the world. So in the end, was the trip judged a success? And what do you think Hawaii gained from it?
It gained diplomatic relations, better diplomatic relations. The late 19th century was a dangerous time for small Pacific island nations. They were looking to avoid getting taken over by Western imperial powers. And one of the best ways to do that for a small country that didn't have a large military was to have good diplomatic relations. And that's what the king cultivated on this trip.
So this tour the king took was in 1881. Hawaii wouldn't become a U.S. state until 1959, nearly 80 years later. But I wonder how the king's tour connected to the moment that Washington started having designs in Hawaii. Because, like, didn't the U.S. essentially stage a coup on the Hawaiian monarchy a few years after the king made this tour?
Yeah, so the U.S. had been interested in Hawaii before the king's reign for economic reasons, eventually for strategic reasons as well. I think that the king's trip didn't specifically lead to increased problems with the United States, but it did, as I had mentioned previously, lead to criticism from his opponents in the kingdom, some of which were strong supporters of annexation to the United States.
What is King David Kalakaua's reputation today in the Hawaiian Islands? How do people think of him?
I think he has a very positive reputation. He built the Royal Palace, Iolani Palace, in downtown Honolulu, which is one of our major landmarks. He's remembered, I think, for his diplomatic efforts, but also for his cultural efforts as well. So throughout the 19th century, Hawaiian culture was pressured by Western influence, and Kalakaua was very instrumental in trying to promote Hawaiian culture and Hawaiian dance and Hawaiian music. Some of that had been suppressed under the influence of Westerners who had come to the kingdom. So he's remembered for his political trips and his diplomacy, but also for his cultural legacy as well.
That's Douglas Askman, a history professor at Hawaii Pacific University in Honolulu, about King Kalakaua's global diplomacy tour of 1881.
That is our circumnavigation of planet Earth on this Monday. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and find our original reporting on YouTube. Be sure to subscribe to our channel there. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Alice Shaver Charitable Trust, Cindy Ingalls, Dodie and Billy Crockett, and Catherine Harris and Tom Kaiser. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.